April 12th, 2006. This is Charles Rust. I'm here visiting with Kirk France about his World War II experiences. And Kirk had some, as usual, some very interesting experience to talk to us about. But first, to set the stage a little bit, Kirk, a little bit, what were you doing before World War II came along? What was your life like before then?
I was fortunate that I got a job with the Anaconda Company in Great Falls. I worked in the zinc plant tank house. I worked in the cadmium. I worked in McDougall furnaces, and they wouldn't let me work in the part under the big stack where they would shovel up arsenic, because the main requirement was you couldn't sweat. They wouldn't let anyone that sweat work with arsenic. And they would shovel it in 50-gallon barrels and ship it back east, wherever back east is. And in 1941, I got a letter from the United States government saying, "Greetings." About April the 20th of 1941, I wound up going to Fort Missoula, where I was inducted into the United States Army. And I was sent to the state of Washington, where I was involved in a Tacoma National Guard outfit that was already in connection with the U.S. Army.
So then that's when you got inducted, is in 41?
1941, yes, sir.
Prior to Pearl Harbor?
I was prior to Pearl Harbor. In fact, on Pearl Harbor, December the 7th, I was walking guard duty in state of California, north of Los Angeles, but there's another town's a little easier, and I can't remember.
That's okay.
But I walked guard duty all night long, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, they said, "Well, you've got to stay on guard duty. Here's a sack lunch." So I was on guard duty on December the 7th.
Well, then kind of what happened to your unit and your outfit and you following that?
Well, we had been stationed in Hawthorne, California, on a big airplane plant, I can't even think of the name of the airplane now. But anyway, we were on top of the air plant on the anti-aircraft unit, where we were to be on the lookout for airplanes that weren't U.S. airplanes. And then a year or a few months after that, in I think it was April, no, it was May of 1942, we were put on a boat and sent up to the Aleutian Islands, where we were stationed for 22 months.
What was the name of the island up there?
The island that we were stationed on is called Umnak. U-M-N-A-K. It is east of another island called Unimak, which has a large military installation. It's about halfway between Shinarsky Bay. Wait a minute. Halfway between, what's that Canadian, or that Russian province up there?
Siberia?
Well, Siberia.
Manchuria? No, I forgot. No, I should know.
Anyway, halfway between Russia and Dutch Harbor. And these islands are very interesting, because this island was about 70 miles long, 30 miles wide. There's a volcano on one end. there was a small settlement of people on the north side of the island, about 70 native people, and I don't exactly know what nationality they would be.
Did they speak English or Russian? Or?
I never spoke to them. I don't know what language they spoke. I only saw them a few times. When we went up there, we went up there by boat, and we had to go into an island called Shinarsky Bay, and the beach on there is covered with rocks about the size of cantaloupes and watermelons, and there's no sand. And then by barge, they loaded everything onto the barges and shipped them over to Pontiac Island, where they were unloaded and carried onto the island. When we were there, it was all tundra. There was no settlement, no nothing. The natives that lived there lived on the north side of the island. We were on the south side of the island. And we slept on the tundra, and that was beautiful because it was about 3 feet tall, and when you laid your sleeping bag on it, it was the most cushioned thing I ever laid on it.
And so you had to build your base from the ground up then?
Well, we lived in tents for a while, and they built all those tin shack things.
Quonsets. The Quonset huts. Yeah, the Quonset
huts. That's what I want. And the bunks in the Quonset huts were about 8 or 10 inches apart because of the number of people there. And we lived in the Quonset huts for quite a while on there. It was very interesting. We were there just a short while, and in order to get the accommodations from Shinarsky Bay over to our island, it had to go by barge. And they have up there a thing called a willywaw. A willywaw is a wind, and it gets over 100 miles an hour and reverses direction of almost 180 degrees in just a few minutes. And if airplanes get caught in that attempting to land, they might get flipped over on the runway. The thing is about the willywaw, it caused the destruction of about 6 barges of accommodations for the military on that island, which included food and about 8 D-8 cats and a whole lot of other equipment for the maintenance of the island. We were allowed to fish on the stream where we caught the most beautiful salmon, about 2 feet long, and they were just like a silver dollar from one end to the other. We were allowed to shoot and eat the caribou that were up there, and that was very delicious meat, let me tell you.
It does taste really good.
It tasted very good. There was red fox on there. There was also an animal called a blue fox. Now, a blue fox is a beautiful animal, about the size of a red fox. The only thing is, when it runs across the ground, it's all black. But if you pick one up, and I had an occasion to pick one up, and what you do, you blow into the fur. And the bottom half of the fur is the prettiest blue you ever saw. The outer half is jet black. The notice on the bulletin board said anyone caught with any portion of a blue fox will be court-martialed. So they had the free run of the place.
They could do whatever they wanted to do, though.
The native people on our island was allowed to come into our PX and pick up food. I have never seen human beings like that. I don't think that any of them that I ever saw, and I only saw a few male members, None of them were over 5 feet, but their shoulders were at least a third broader than the average individual. And the several people that I saw that smiled, I never saw a white tooth. They were all black, and I could never figure out why. But they were allowed to come to our PX area and pick up various portions of food. The thing is that we lived on an isolated terminal as an anti-aircraft outfit.
You were strictly anti-aircraft?
We were strictly anti-aircraft. 37 millimeter, 40 millimeter, 50 caliber. And when we first got there, and the boat went into the Shinarsky Bay, two Jap Zero airplanes dropped out of the sky below the cloud level. The cloud level in that area is very unique because it's only about 300 feet above sea level, and it's that way about 20 hours out of 24, most all of the time. It's very heavy cloud cover. The Jap Zeros dropped out of the sky, flew for a short distance, and went back up into the clouds, and we never saw them again. We never even got a chance to get over to the anti-aircraft outfit.
You never got a chance to pull the trigger.
Never saw them again. But it always interested me in the respect that these Jap Zeros were up in that area. I didn't realize until years later that the Japanese fleet of nearly 1,100 ships, including the largest battleship in the world, went up through that north side of the islands we were on, went over the Dutch harbor, and apparently, through concern for the welfare of Japan, they did a 180-degree turn and went back down into the South Pacific. This has always intrigued me when this information was brought about, because I understood that their idea was to come down the Pacific coast, and with 1,100 ships like they had at that time, the damage they could have done to the west coast of the United States would have been something terrific. We were there for 22 months. In that time period, the Seabees came up just after we got there, and they bulldozed a runway. Now, this runway did not have an airport, and it was not concrete. It was made out of metal, steel items that were linked together, and the airplanes could land and take off on that. The thing about it is that if the wind came up and that Willy Wah was going to hit the airport, sometimes if there were 40 or 50 planes attempting to land, half of them may land going east, and the other half would have to turn direction around and land west, because they could not, they couldn't function going with the Willy Wah. It would flip the plane over if they got caught in the right spot up there.
Well, why did you have so many airplanes flying in and out of there?
The idea of the airplanes up there has always intrigued me. The United States government apparently sent a lot of P-40s and P-38 airplanes up to this runway. The Russians would fly into our runway and pick up those airplanes and fly them back to Russia. Why and how the United States gave Russia that many airplanes, and the exact number, I have no way to know. It has always intrigued me that the Russians got all those planes. The Russian pilots did not like safety equipment on their runway. They would take out the safety equipment for the pilot, pilot on the runway, take off with the plane and go to Russia. I understood in some people giving guess that some of that weighed 600 pounds or so off of that P-40 or P-38 plane. What has always intrigued me about this particular phenomenon is that after the Cold War got started, where Russia went into Berlin, is there a possibility that our P-38s and P-40s were used by the Russians against our military there in Berlin? I have no way to know, but I certainly have a right to raise it as a question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole thing always intrigued me a great deal, because I was up there and walked on the airport, or no, on the runway, and spent most of my time in the outfit that I was in.
That is an intriguing sort of a thing, what eventually might have happened with those airplanes, isn't it?
Well, it is. Mm-hmm. What happened to those airplanes has always interested me, because I have never, ever heard anything in the news media about the transportation mm-hmm. of Russian or American equipment given to Russia mm-hmm. and the consequences thereafter. But the thing is that I don't know where to go and ask questions.
That's right. And where would you go, and would they give you the answer?
Well, there was another interesting aspect on that. There was two islands up there called Kiska and Attu.
Yeah.
And we had some famous battles up there. But when I was up there, there was a confrontation taking place on one of those islands, and I'm not sure which one. But the story that I heard when I was on Umneck Island was the American soldiers came up one side of the island, the Canadian soldiers came up the other side. I have never heard the total figure of the number of what is called friendly fire casualties, but it has always raised a curiosity with me, because that's the mm-hmm. only time in my life I ever heard of that particular incident. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come out in the news media or in the military things that I see on television. But
friendly fire is a very sad thing in the military, and it
does happen. Friendly fire is a very sad thing, and it's regrettable that it has to happen, mm-hmm. but it has happened.
Yes, it has. And apparently even happened in Afghanistan, they said, here a year or two ago. So
yeah, I'm afraid it did.
Yeah, a few. But now Attu, there was a battle on Attu Island, wasn't there?
There was a very tough battle on
Attu. Yes.
Yeah, and the Americans lost heavily on that, mm-hmm. but so did the Japanese.
Yeah. How far were you from Attu, generally speaking? Very close or quite a ways away?
I can't give you the mileage, because I've never seen a picture mm-hmm. or geography or whatever mm-hmm. that drew mileage. The thing mm-hmm. is that Umneck was probably mm-hmm. closer to Attu and Kiska than they were to Dutch Harbor. Now, that part of the world intrigues me because of the time I spent mm-hmm. up there. When we were on Umneck Island, there were lots and lots and lots of caribou. Mm-hmm. They had two theaters there. What's that got to do with caribou? Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. When I was there, I would stand in line to go to one of the theaters. Young caribou would walk up. How they got trained to do this, I don't know. Young. The old caribou didn't do this, but the young ones did. And the guys would hand up cigarettes, and those caribou loved those cigarettes.
Oh.
They would eat those things, these young caribou. It was very interesting to see these things walk up to the line of military personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on the point, on one point of the island, for our anti-aircraft unit, when the Navy came up and brought the Seabees with them to bulldoze in the runway. They surrounded our outfit, and we were allowed to go into the Navy PXs and stuff. And they always had cake and coffee in one of the big rooms, which I always thought was a real treat.
Yes.
So it was kind of nice.
Now, what was your specific job there while you were there? What were you assigned to do?
Well, when I first got up there, I was on observation gunpoint position. We had a crew out there where we had our anti-aircraft guns. The thing that changed my whole aspect on life was, about the fourth or fifth night that I come in and wanted to go to bed, you understand it's 4 hours on and 4 hours off. And the 4 hours off don't give you a lot of time to get rested up and sleep. I come in on about the fourth day at about 2 a.m, and these beds that are in this Quonset hut are about 8 or 10 inches apart. And the sergeant and the corporal and several others were sitting, two of them on one edge of my bed, two on another bed, with one bed in between used as a table, and they were playing poker. That's fine, except for what they did. In other words, if the guy was going to trump an ace or take a trick, he would raise his hand up in the air, flap the card down on the bed, and raise his butt up in the air, and then bang his butt down on mine. And I was trying to sleep. So I about the fourth time that happened, I very carefully turned to the sergeant, and I said, "Sergeant, that's not very nice. Don't do that no more. Do you understand what I said? I don't see how you could. When you're in the military and you're out on a gun post, every word of English is 1/4 of the language that is used, and the 3/4 is the most profane that you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand what I said to the sergeant. I'm not going to tell you.
I don't want it on tape. I've been in the military. No. I can guess.
So the next morning, he says, "I've turned you in." The sergeant told me, he says, "I've turned you in to headquarters." He said, "Disrespectful to a non-commissioned officer." And I went in and I told the captain about it. And he said, "Well," he said, "you're going to get 2 weeks of steady KP." Okay, so I got 2 weeks steady KP. But do you know what? It was so nice because I could go to one of the two theaters in the evening if I wanted to. I could eat, and I didn't have to sit try to sleep on a bunk with guys that are playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, "Well, I like this." And so the guys that were assigned KP, I would do their duty, and I wound up as a steady KP. I wound up working in the kitchen. I wound up working with the cooks and baking various kinds of biscuits and sort of things. And for 2 years, so I learned how to be a cook. And then when I come back to the United States, they assigned me to a unit in Florida that did not have any cooks. And the captain in that place says, "You know what, your record shows that you're an 060. An 060 says kitchen help. says, so you're going to cook. So I cooked for nearly 6 weeks as a first cook to 180 outfit. And he said, I can't make you a sergeant. From now on, you're corporal. Mm. So I was there for a few months and then was changed from corporal to sergeant. Mm. And I spent most of my life in the kitchen. I liked working in the kitchen.
Well, you went from the islands down to Florida then?
And then well, we went from the islands down into a little military camp north of Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. And it was in August. Mm-hmm. And I never had a dry piece of clothes all the while I was there. Everything was wet with sweat. And that was a hot country. After being almost 2 years up in the Aleutian Islands, my system did not adapt very readily to the temperatures there in Texas. Mm-hmm. But then I was sent from there over to Camp Blending in Florida, mm-hmm. and assigned to kitchen duty and wound up as first cook, mm-hmm. for nearly 3 weeks. All by myself, over 160 new recruits coming into the Army. Mm.
So then did you keep cooking up until
I cooked until the day I was discharged, which was in October of 1945.
And you were in Florida at that time?
I was in Florida at that time.
That must have been quite a change. I hadn't thought of it, being up in the islands with the temperature the way it is, and then moving to the southern U.S., that had to be quite cold.
I'm telling you, when the irony of the thing was, mm-hmm. I had wool clothes on. Mm-hmm. But the irony of the thing is that a lot of the soldiers that went to fight on mm-hmm. Attu and Kiska did not have wool clothes. Mm-hmm. They had cotton, and they suffered. Mm-hmm. And they tried, and I've seen articles on that mm-hmm. where they tried to wear the shoes of a Japanese that had been mm-hmm. killed, but they are too small.
Yeah.
So they had trouble mm-hmm. because the clothes they had, they were not really dressed for the temperature change mm-hmm. from where they were in the United States up into those islands. Mm-hmm. They didn't have wool clothes. They didn't mm-hmm. have heavy parkas. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a lot of things in there, and a lot of those, talk to any of those fellows that were on that, you can find out that mm-hmm. that was a real tough ordeal for mm-hmm. them while mm-hmm. those guys were up there.
That would be without the right clothing. Well, what kinds of things that affected you, what kind of adverse things when you were on the island did you have? Any real uncomfortable sort of things happen, living-wise or otherwise?
I got by pretty well after mm-hmm. I got to being after I got to working in the kitchen, uh-huh. it worked out pretty good. Mm-hmm. The only real situation I've already described about the card games on that.
Yeah.
Because it...
And you had adequate food delivered, so everybody had a good food supply?
Well, I'll tell you what, when we were cooking in our outfit on that island, the officers from headquarters would come over and eat. There was two things about that. One had to do with the caribou. Our outfit, when they said, who wants to volunteer to go get some caribou, I don't think there was a hand that didn't go up that wanted to volunteer to go hunt caribou.
Yes.
And they got, I don't know how many they got, but we had meat all over, to the extent that a lot of officers from other parts of the area up there come over to our mess hall. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was rather interesting.
Yes.
Yes.
At that time in the islands, corresponding back home with your family, how did that work? How long did letters take?
Well, letters took quite a while, but we had a restriction. We were forbidden to identify anything with our outfit or the island we were on, our location or anything. Uh-huh. All of our letters were scrutinized or overlooked.
Edited
they were
carefully.
Looked over, I mean.
Yeah, edited very carefully.
Yeah, by one of the officers. And if you put the word umnak on there, he took a razor blade and cut it out. He didn't rub it off.
Oh, is that right?
So, so you had to be careful about trying to identify where you were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one other interesting thing about that island, there was about 5,000 head of sheep on that island. Now, this is a very interesting story because they hadn't been sheared in 2 years. And so the outfit, or, you know, the commander said, well, who would like to go out and help round up the sheep? And I don't think there was a hand that didn't go up in the outfit. They wanted to go.
They wanted to have that chance, yes.
And so they went out and they started to round up the sheep, but they made one bad mistake. They didn't keep a distance between the shore of the island and the sheep all went out into the ocean. And they were sent out there and bobbed up and down in the water. I don't know that any of them drowned, but the next day they were back on the island. And
I'll be darned.
And they rounded them up. They sheared the wool off of the animals, and they set a record because the fleeces on those animals run up to 33 pounds, which is exceptional as far as the weight of a fleece is concerned. The story that I heard, who owns the sheep, I always thought was very interesting. Because the story that came down to us, it's owned by the Aleutian Livestock Company of Salt Lake City.
Of Salt Lake City?
And I have never contacted them in Salt Lake City. But we all always got a big kick out of it because I often wondered how they got up there.
That is, I would wonder the same thing. How did they get up there?
But the thing is, it was rather interesting.
Yes, yes. Well, the natives that lived on the island, you said you had very little contact with them. What kind of clothing did they wear, and where did they get it, do you know?
I don't know for sure, because we didn't have... I only saw them a couple times in the almost 2 years I was there. They wore skins, basically.
Okay.
Now, as I understand it, in what I have read and heard about later, many of the natives on these islands were transported by the United States government into parts of Alaska. And they really had a problem because they wound up getting diseased. They wound up getting into alcohol that they were not used to, and they paid, well, they just suffered terribly
from
it. I've heard stories about it, and that's all I've heard, so I don't care to go into all the stories.
No, no, that's right. Now, your Quonsets you lived in, did you have fuel oil type stoves to heat the Quonsets with, or?
Yes, we had fuel oil in our Quonsets.
So they were reasonably comfortable then?
Yes, their Quonset huts were reasonably comfortable. I remember you know, wine is a very interesting thing. Do you know how you make wine? You take a gallon jug, you fill it full of some kind of fruit, whether it's cherries or whatever. You put a little yeast in it, and you kind of leave it sit for a while. And I imagine that in our Quonset hut, on the end of the cup, there was about 30 or so of these things where guys were trying to make some kind of wine out of it. I had a gallon jug that I filled with parts of grapes and I had it hanging in my well, I have a, it was a big fur coat, but not a fur coat, but a wool coat, a heavy army coat,
yes.
A dress coat thing, not the not the parka type thing. And I hid it in there because these guys would go through and try to find find whatever you've got. And I remember after it had been there for, I don't know, several months, I made a bad mistake of looking at it, and these guys saw it. And then there were several come in and picked it up and looked at it. And, but there must have been 20 or so of the containers between gallon jugs and crocks that were sitting on the porch in our outfit where these guys were trying. They tried to make wine out of every possible thing they could get their hands on. I never saw such a variety of stuff. I remember one guy had one, he had it in a little wooden keg, and I think what he tried to do was hide it, and he put it either under his bed or under a desk between the two beds, and the stuff got to working real good. All of a sudden, about a gallon of it squirted up out all over the floor.
He had good action going there.
Yeah.
He was being successful, but what a mess. Now, you showed me this book. You said you took up photography and film developing while you were there. How did that
happen?
Well,
yeah, we had just black and white film,
mm-hmm.
and it's not very difficult to get the chemical, and we could get it at the PX, mm-hmm. where you could develop that roll of film yourself.
Okay.
If you, I don't even remember now how I did it, but I did it.
Yeah. Obviously, you got some good pictures. Yeah.
Well, that's only probably a 20th of them,
I suppose.
But I have a box of them someplace, mm-hmm. but a lot of them are not.
So you just had to learn it yourself.
Well, there were guys there that told us about
there
it,
were
that,
guys
that had experience in it, mm-hmm. by working in a photo shop.
Okay.
So they explained,
mm-hmm.
What the technique was. I can't tell you what it is today, but
no.
I must have developed a dozen or more rolls of film up there that, mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun,
sure.
in my spare hours to keep, mm-hmm. from being bored.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of interesting. What do you do when you're time off?
Mm-hmm.
These guys, a lot of them play cards, and a lot of them do this and that. At Christmas time, when the Air Force is flying people up there, the people in the Air Force are allowed to bring one bag with them, with their clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But in that bag, they will go into the PX in the United States and fill it full of whiskey and liquor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what they get for it when they get up on the island?
About four times what they pay.
They
least.
$75 to $100
Is
a bottle.
Is that right? Oh my God!
These guys up there, I thought, what on earth are you guys doing paying that kind of money? But see, that's the only alcohol that a lot of them ever got up there. Mm-hmm. And the pilots on those planes would fill these bags as full as, mm-hmm. you know, 8 or 10 or 12 or 20 bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And they
made a fortune.
They made a fortune.
Yes. Poor devils, they're off you got. Well, then at the holiday season, did they bring any entertainers to your island? Or?
Yes. And I think I got a picture of one movie star up there, and I can't even think of her name anymore,
mm-hmm.
that came onto the island.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we did not have entertainment up there that I can recall.
Uh-huh.
We had visitors,
mm-hmm.
that would come onto the island, but...
No musical entertainment or anything like that?
No, I have no recall of any of that.
They might not have started that yet at that time. Because I understand they did a fair amount of that in sort of some places.
Well, they did in some later on. Well, I know Jack Benny was real famous for his attributes to the American military.
Yes.
He really supported them.
Mm-hmm.
But Aleutian Islands, I think, was kind of...
Yeah, out of the way for
them.
They
were kind of shoved off on a... Mm-hmm. I don't know, they don't even talk about it much today.
No. Well, that would be the end of the line. They'd go there and come back where they went elsewhere. I suppose they made several stops.
Yep.
So they just brought you alcohol at the holidays. Well, it's amazing what guys will spend for some stuff that they don't
amazing.
Have it for a while.
It's amazing how many of them had that much money up there.
Well, yes. Well,
see, a lot of I think we didn't get paid up there.
Well,
I don't
you didn't
think.
Get paid while you were there.
I don't. I think we were. Well, it was. Where do you put it?
Yeah. If you got it, what do you do with it? Yeah.
I don't recall getting any money up there that I know of. If I did, I put it in my pocket or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't recall I don't recall a bank or anything up there.
Well, when you went to the PX, did you have to buy that? Did you have to have cash for that, too? Or
you know, I never bought that much in the PX. I had no occasion to
go. Well, yeah, as a cook, you had access to everything that you needed, basically. I just remember guys going to PX to buy candy and other things like that.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, I just can't relate to that right now. I just, I don't remember. I didn't think I got paid up there.
Is that right? Well,
if I did, I know some of the guys had their money sent home. But I don't recall, I never had
any reason to use
it. I don't remember at all up there.
Well, when you came back home from the island, did you come back by ship or did they fly you back when they came back to the States? When you finished your assignment?
You know what? I hadn't even thought of that. I don't...
You just got there and got home.
I don't think I flew back.
Probably not in World War II.
I think I don't think I flew back.
Yeah, probably came by water. World War II, most everybody did if they weren't, unless you were in the Air Force.
I do remember, though, that when we were on that barge going from Shinarsky Bay over to the island, we were told on several occasions, don't fall overboard, because if we can't get you within 15 minutes, we'll leave you, because you'll be gone.
Anyhow, the water is that cold.
The water is that cold that you can't survive in it. So it's... I don't know how those ship captains and those guys in the aboard ship navigate in that area up there, because you can't call them islands, but they're rocks that stick up out of the water.
Yeah.
And some of them are several hundred feet high, and some of them are several... Just a couple of 3 acres up to maybe, and I have looked at those up there to the point to where they would be covered with algae and moss, and they would be a dark shiny because they were all wet and slippery. The Air Force was told not to drop out of the clouds down And when they flew up, they flew under the cloud cover. Mm-hmm. And that's a 12-hour flight or so.
Gee,
and those guys were dragged out when they landed on that island up there.
Yeah, because that... Sure, and all those... I'm with you. I don't know how they navigate in those kind of shallows and all those rocks and everything. I just don't understand.
Well, it was dangerous to fly in the clouds and then drop down up in there. Because it's not an isolated...